Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And we are about to launch into a series of 3 classic episodes. So for the next couple of weeks, we're going to have these classics play out. These were episodes that I recorded and published the week of March 2nd, 2015, so quite some time ago. It ties into some stuff that I've touched on in some other episodes recently, like I talked about the video game crash of 1983. We're going to talk about the rise and fall of Atari. Now, this was a 3-part series that I did. I have a special guest on these shows, so I hope you enjoy that. But let's listen to The Rise and Fall of Atari, Part 1, which published March 2nd, 2015. Enjoy. Hi, Jonathan. Since you asked, I do have a suggestion for a topic to cover that I don't think you have yet. Could you do an episode or two, if needed, to cover the rise and fall of Atari? I actually worked in a store that sold only Atari home computers and game systems in the early 90s.
Wow.
Atari's products are at the time were as good or better than what was being put out by their competitors, and yet they failed big time. Thank you for the entertaining and educational show. I enjoyed part one of the 2014 review this morning. So clearly this request came in some time ago.
Yeah, I guess so.
But yeah, this was one that when I brought it up to you, you said absolutely we should do an episode about Atari.
Well, you and I are the same age, roughly.
Yeah.
And we are children of Atari in
yes.
every way.
Yeah, we grew up in the 70s and 80s during the Atari's heyday.
Yeah, and it was huge, huge in my life. And my brother actually has set his up recently, and I was just playing Combat last week.
Combat, and we'll get to this obviously, was the game that shipped with the Atari 2600.
And it kind of holds up
You know, it really does. It's an incredibly simple game and has incredibly simple graphics, but it's the playability comes in the fact that it's a two-player game.
Yep.
And trash talking galore can happen.
We had a blast playing it last weekend. It really was a lot of fun. And not just for nostalgia. The gameplay, like you said, still holds up to a certain degree, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's obviously for someone who's like, no, I need to have, you know, the 14 different controls mapped out on my keyboard and my gaming mouse and everything.
Different.
It's not going to appeal to you.
Yeah.
But it's still a compelling experience. So we wanted to go through the rise and fall of Atari, and it is an epic story. I mean, it has so many different elements to it, and it's at least going to be two episodes. We're going to see how far we can go before we have to take a break and replenish our vital bodily fluids.
Before we break out.
Exactly. good reference there, Mr. Chuck.
Thank you.
So starting off, a little information before we get into the actual Atari days. Computer games have been around pretty much since the days that computers were first built.
Yeah.
You know, you have computer programmers who often had these analytical minds that were also fond of things like puzzles and games. And so naturally, when those early computer programs were being designed, programmers were thinking, huh, I wonder if I could actually make this machine do something fun, not just something functional.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things you probably heard a lot in the early days would, well, maybe that'd be fun if ...
Right.
And before you know it, they were playing some, you know, to us, an archaic form of a video game.
Yeah, maybe like a game version of like tic-tac-toe.
Right.
You know, but instead of it having a video screen, because video screens were late in the game in the computer days.
Yeah.
They would print this stuff out. Like you would have maybe a tape printer and it would print each move. So every time something changed, it had to print a new piece of paper for you to look at, or a new strip of tape, really.
Cause that's crazy.
A friend of mine, his name's Richard Garriott.
Uh-huh.
And he's a big game developer. He created one of the big computer game successes in the 80s and 90s called Ultima. And he talks about in his days when he was in computer programming classes in high school, it was all printed to tape. And it was like a little adventure game.
Uh-huh.
And we'll talk about adventure in a bit too, where it would print out the room and your little position, like you'd be a little X in the room. And you'd say, go left. It would have to print a new version of it where the X was just slightly to the left.
Wow. This is in the pre-eco-friendly days as well.
Yes.
Burning through paper tape.
These days, such a game would probably be frowned upon.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it sets the stage to show that people realized there was potential for electronics in the game world. And that gets us up to 1958 when a man named William Higginbotham of Brookhaven National Laboratory.
Yes.
Developed an electronic game called Tennis for Two on a Donner Model 30 analog computer. And it would simulate table tennis, and it simulated velocity and changes in direction, all this kind of stuff.
I looked it up just to see what it looked like.
Yeah.
It looked like sort of like a ship's sonar.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah, exactly. It was taking an oscillator.
Yeah.
I mean, the same sort of thing that you might see as like a heart monitor in a hospital.
Yeah, totally.
Kind of like that. And by fiddling with the voltage, essentially, he could change the different images so that you would have essentially two paddle-like things and a ball-like thing and play a very basic game. And he said that he had made it because people would come to visit the lab and there wasn't a whole lot of stuff that was actually interesting to look at. They'd get bored. And so this was a way to entertain them.
That's pretty funny to impress people.
Yeah.
He had stuff that was far more advanced, but he's like, oh, but look at this Tennis for Two. And people were like, ooh.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, fascinating.
This cutting edge.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you ever seen the Mel Brooks film Silent Movie?
Oh, yeah.
All right. In Silent Movie, there's actually a scene where Sid Caesar is in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
His character is in the hospital. And it's Dom DeLuise and Marty Feldman who walk up to his heart monitor and turn it into this game.
Oh, that's right.
And they play a game of Pong on his heart monitor,
which totally forgot about
causes
that.
Him to totally freak out.
Yeah.
But it's this game.
Which is interesting because the original, well, we'll get into Pong, but the original Pongs were silent.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually true. And in 1962, that's when we get up to the time when MIT professor Steve Russell developed a game called Space War, which is one of the earliest video games. He did this with two of his students, and they built it for a big mainframe computer.
Yeah, it was the only way they could really at the time.
Yeah, exactly. So if you wanted to play a computer game, you had to go someplace where essentially a room is dedicated to that computer.
The Big Mac.
Yeah, they were largely still using vacuum tubes for a lot of this technology. Uh-huh. I mean, transistors had started to come out, but they hadn't been integrated into computers deeply at this point. And that's when, around this time is when an electrical engineering student named Nolan Bushnell, probably the most important person in this story.
Yeah, for sure.
That's when he discovered space war, because the computer lab at the university he was going to, the University of Utah College of Engineering, had space war on one of its computers.
Yeah, he was, I saw an interview with him earlier today on YouTube where he was talking about, at the time, he said there were only like 4 universities in the entire country that had graphical displays.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
And University of Utah just happened to be one of them.
Yeah.
And it seemed like when you start hearing about the story and how it all just fell into place, I don't know if I'm a believer in fate, but all these little puzzle pieces came together in just the right way to get his motor running, basically.
Yeah, if any of the elements that took place, then the whole arcade industry could have been delayed by several years.
Sure. If he had just gone to a different university that didn't have computer screens.
Right. Yeah. Because the University of Utah was a pioneer in that space.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he really got his introduction to it. Another interesting thing about him is that he would work in his off time, like whenever school was out, at the Lagoon Amusement Park.
Yeah, that was a huge deal, because that inspired the thought of, you know what, people are shoving quarters in these skee-ball games and pinball and, you know, all manner of sort of boardwalk arcade games.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously had some sort of business sense to him, because he thought, why not try and do this really fun thing that I've been sneaking into the lab and doing every night and charge people money for it.
Right. What if we were to create an experience using an electronic game where on a per coin basis you would get either an allotted amount of time to play or some other metric, like in Pong, it might be the number of lives. In most video games, it's number of lives, but in a few, it's time. And that would determine how much of that experience you could have before you had to plunk in another quarter.
Yeah.
And if I find it so compelling that I'll sneak into the lab, people be willing to pay a quarter for it.
Yeah, it was a stroke of genius.
It was, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of criticisms that are leveled against Bushnell, including people who used to work with him.
Yeah.
And a lot of people claim, well, he never invented anything. I have to object to that, because he took 2 separate ideas and turned them into something that spawned an entire industry. And if that's not invention, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and whether or not he was, I guess it wasn't coding, but whether or not he was soldering the games and inventing the games themselves, those games are worthless unless someone comes along and says, you know what, I know how to package this and take it to the public for them to enjoy.
Right. And so, I mean, so without this vision, again, I'm sure we would have eventually come around to the arcade industry anyway. Someone would have come up with that idea, but it would have been later.
Right.
And the story might have been much different. So Bushnell graduates from college and goes to work for a company called Ampex. Now, this is around 1969. Ampex is an electronics company. And I got a little bit of trivia, something I thought you would appreciate, Chuck.
What's that?
You're a musician.
Yes.
So Ampex developed a tape recorder that Les Paul used to pioneer the sound-on-sound technique.
No way.
Yeah, Les Paul used an Ampex tape recorder, which was designed to have a secondary writing head that would allow him to record a track and then play along with that recorded track to create a new mixed track of both of them together.
Huh.
So this would allow one musician to essentially back him or herself up.
Yeah, yeah.
However, what it did do also is destroy the original track, the original recording, because it records over it. So you no longer have that. So it was
You have you plus you.
Yes.
And that's the new bass version.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. I thought that you would appreciate that. So Ampex,
that's awesome.
Ampex has had a real important part in the electronics industry in general. But it also plays host to the meeting of the two people who would really push Atari in the early days. Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney.
Yeah, and Dabney, they met in 1969, and like you said, both employees of Ampex, and both very much interested in pioneering Space War.
Yeah.
As the very first video game.
Yeah, they were looking at Space War, and they thought, how can we make this as a coin-operated game? Now, clearly, we can't do the same thing that Space War is doing, because having a mainframe computer
right.
is not something you can install in your local bar.
So, yeah.
So we have to figure out how to take this same concept, but do it in a much smaller form factor that could be a coin-operated game.
Yeah, and that turned out to be sort of a recurring thing in Bushnell's career was,
yes.
This guy did something really neat. Let me sort of make a very similar version.
Yeah.
But in a much like sleeker package that's consumer oriented.
Yeah, I read a transcript of an interview that that Ted Dabney did.
Yeah, I read a lot of that actually.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, there's clearly some bad blood between
sure.
the two of them.
Yeah.
But Dabney talked about how what would happen is Bushnell would come up to him and say, I want to do this. How is that possible?
Right.
Dabney would figure it out, tell him, and then Bushnell would go off and do it.
Right.
So Bushnell had skills, but Dabney always dismissed it as saying he wasn't an engineer. He could do something if you told him how to do it, but
right.
he couldn't engineer it himself.
Yeah, he was he was sort of like a producer almost.
Yeah.
Like and really good at getting super talented people together to create a vision.
Yeah, sort of like you could think of other pairings that this applies to, like
yeah.
Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who will come up later.
Yeah.
Or Paul Allen and Bill Gates. I mean, there are a lot
Ben
of different
Jerry.
References. Yeah, Ben and Jerry. Itchy and Scratchy. We can just keep throwing out pair names out there. So it was the beginning of a partnership that would end up launching this arcade industry idea.
Yeah. So they got together and they said, well, let's sort of copy that game in,
yeah.
in a cabinet version.
Yep.
But we don't really have the money to fund this. So they took it to a few different people, finally landed at a place called Nutting Associates.
Right.
Who agreed to finance a game, which was really the very first arcade game called Computer Space.
Yep. Yep. They got a programmer by the name of Larry Bryan to come on board. Larry Bryan had also worked at Ampex. They formed a company that they originally called Syzygy.
Yeah. They just said the name kind of sounded and looked cool.
Yeah. Which, by the way, if you don't know how to spell it, it's of course one of those, spelling bee words. It's S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. And it refers to the planetary alignment.
Oh, really?
When things come into alignment, they're in Syzygy.
I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah.
It had a real meaning.
It was one of my father's favorite words. No joke. So that was instilled in my brain at an early age. They come up with this name, which they wouldn't stick with for reasons we'll get to. They thought about using a computer called the Data General Nova 800, but it's pretty expensive and it still wasn't really going to fit their needs. So they weren't really sure how they were going to do this. Originally, the idea was that all three of the initial founding members,
yeah.
Dabney, Bushnell, and Brian, were going to contribute $100 into a group fund to be like the owner operating
right.
capital. Only Dabney and Bushnell did. Brian
Man.
Never did. So,
do you know why? Was it because he didn't want to throw in $100?
I don't know. I never came across. It was just a lot of matter of fact of, yeah, Brian never put his $100
right.
in. It's just never an explanation.
Major mistake, my friend.
Yeah. And so, eventually both Bushnell and Dabney would put in an extra $250. So that brought the owner's equity up to a incredible $700.
Unbelievable.
Princely sum for this company. And like you were saying, Chuck, they went to Nutting to say, like, maybe you can help us by manufacturing this thing. We'll retain the rights to the game.
Yeah.
You'll be able to manufacture it and sell it, but we get royalties for it as well.
And it's the next big thing.
Yeah. They convinced Nutting
yeah.
that it's the next big thing. So Nutting Associates has no clue about this stuff. They essentially give them the space to do whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
Thinking like, all right, well, we can't do this ourselves. We're going to let this group do this. And if it pays off, it's huge. We'll be making lots of money. And if it doesn't, well, we'll just call it a loss. So the agreement included a 5% royalty on unit sales. So that's what the group would get.
Uh-huh.
And the units were relatively inexpensive. They were like $1,095, which in today's money is about $6,000 a
yeah.
piece.
But it was not for the home consumer. It was
no.
for, you know,
this is
put
like,
in the bar.
Yeah, exactly. This would be like a restaurant. Yeah, that's, or maybe a bowling alley, something
right.
like that. But remember, there's no market for these yet.
Well, yeah, no one knows.
Because they didn't exist.
Yeah, it's just crazy to think about. No one knew if it was going to work at all.
Right.
And so, it sort of did and it sort of didn't. It wasn't a big success for them at all.
Right, right. And the, one of the problems was that this game that was based off Space War, just like Space War, was kind of complicated. It was a game built by engineers for engineers.
Yeah.
So you see like all these buttons and dials and stuff and you think, all right, this does not appear to be intuitive in any
sure.
way.
Sure. No one really understood how to play it. It looked a little like Asteroids.
Yeah.
As far as just the look of the game.
Yeah. And it's one of those that when you look at it, you think, you know, I don't even know what it is, like how I control the things, nor do I know what I'm supposed to do. So it had some limited success, but it wasn't a runaway hit. It just wasn't that simplistic experience that the average person could immediately identify.
Well, yeah, plus it was, I mean, people were used to seeing a pinball machine maybe, but if you look up this thing online, there's all of a sudden it seems they're, you know, arcade games to us now, yeah. were so ubiquitous, the game cabinet itself. But when you look at this thing at the time, no one knew what the heck it was.
Right.
There was this weird looking yellow pod
right
with a TV screen in it
exactly
in the corner, and I have no idea with all this little gamepad on the front of it, and what am I even supposed to do with that on my way to the bathroom?
I mean, the whole thing wouldn't have even been possible except for the fact that Dabney made a breakthrough while he was tooling around in his home, according to the interviews I've seen, in his daughter's bedroom. He used that as his workspace.
Yeah, he moved one of his daughters in with the other.
Yeah.
He had two daughters. He was like, I need your room.
Yeah, this is going to be my lab.
Exactly.
And he started playing with cathode ray tube video screens without the use of a computer as a input. And he used counters and gates, basic electronic components, to manipulate that CRT display to create the images on a screen that you could control by changing the values directly. So think of, you know, you remember the tracking on a TV when the screen would be rolling and you have to adjust the tracking so that because we're old, we remember this stuff.
Uh-huh.
That was the basis of him being able to control vertical movement.
Oh, okay.
On a screen. He just essentially, he manufactured a way of doing that where by using a control, you could change the input into the television and make that vertical movement possible. For horizontal, you had to change voltages in a really interesting way so that you could get horizontal movement. Otherwise, you would only be able to move up and down.
Now, was that the spot motion circuit?
Yes.
Okay, and that changed everything because this meant for the first time that he could create a game that didn't need a computer attached to it.
Right.
You could do a home version of this game.
Yes, exactly. And then everything that you would need for the game, you could build onto the circuit. And that meant that every circuit for every game was unique, right? Like one, if you look at two different arcade games from this era, the game is all hardwired on the circuitry, and those circuit boards are going to look different because it's those physical components that create the assets of each game.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool to think about because these days,
totally.
We're used to the general purpose machine, right? The computer.
Uh-huh.
And then everything else is controlled on the software side.
Right.
But this was all hardware.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for someone.
I imagine every game was a little different from the next, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And you look at it, you think like, well, you know, there could even be production errors
in that
could create weird glitches that are only for that unit of the game. It's not like a game shipped with glitches. It'd be that maybe some solder wasn't complete. And so something in the game's not working properly. So it made it more like those early arcade machines were really more like pinball games than they were like the modern games.
We'll be back with more of the rise and fall of Atari after these messages.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
We get to August of 1971. That's when the team had produced the test unit of their game, which was, as you were saying, called Computer Space. And they set it up in a restaurant and bar called Dutch Goose in Palo Alto, California.
What a great name.
They officially debuted the game at the 1971 Music and Amusement Machines Exposition in Chicago. And by the end of 1971, they began to ship the game. So that first game was just sort of a test run to see if they could get it to look. Now, it doesn't do great business because it was so complicated.
About 1,500 units total sold.
Yeah.
But it was enough money for Dabney and Bushnell to sort of continue to fund their company.
Right. They decided at that point that they wanted to incorporate Syzygy, and then they hit a speed bump because they realized, they found out, there was already another company using the name Syzygy.
Yeah, apparently it was a little candle company in Mendocino, California, some hippies.
So that put their plans on pause as they had to rethink the name. And also at that time in 1972, Bushnell would attend a meeting that would later come back to haunt him.
Yeah.
He attended a meeting that had a presentation of the Magnavox Odyssey, which is a home video game console that featured several silent games, the most notable one being a table tennis game.
Yeah, and who was the man's name? Bear?
Yeah.
Was the head of Magnavox at the time.
Yeah.
He invented a thing called the Brown Box, which was later changed to the Magnavox Odyssey.
Right.
And like you said, I think a lesson to be learned here is never sign the guest book.
Right.
Because Bushnell signed the guest book as an attendee. And these, before they took the Odyssey to market, they had these very special small batch screenings.
Yeah.
For invitees only.
Right.
And which wasn't the smartest thing in the world to do either.
Yeah, because
even though they did have a patent on it,
it would allow people that chance to maybe we could beat them to market by creating something similar.
Yeah. And that's exactly what happened in the case of Bushnell.
Yeah, so this would come back to haunt him later. And if you are going to go to one of these meetings, don't leave a paper trail.
No,
that's the lesson there. So by June, Bushnell and Dabney incorporate as Atari Incorporated.
Yes. Which the name came from a Japanese game board game called Go.
Yeah.
Which Bushnell was just crazy for.
Yeah.
And apparently the meaning of it is basically the equivalent to I've got you in check. I'm about to take all your stones is what he said.
Right, right. And I think the root word was a taru, which means to hit a target. And
a cool sounding name.
Yeah.
Like it jumped out at him at the time as like, I like it.
Right. And
it's grabby.
They create some common stock, which collectively would value the company at about $75,000. A big jump from the $700 that they had in the bank at the time. And the famous Atari logo, I didn't put this in the notes, but it was designed by a guy named George Opperman. Now, according to Opperman, the two side pieces, like if you look at the Atari logo, it's got three kind of columns. The two on either side sort of slope away.
Yeah, I've always wondered what that was.
It's a stylized A.
Okay.
So that's one thing. Some people call it the Mount Fuji logo because they think it looks like Mount Fuji. Opperman says the two side pieces represented opposing players and the middle straight section represented the center line in Pong.
Oh.
Which is kind of cool. The whole logo was that stylized A, and Opperman was the in-house artist for Atari and created a lot of the art that the arcade cabinets were sporting.
Well, it's certainly iconic now, you know?
Yeah.
You see that logo and it just, for guys our age, it just really conjures up a lot.
Well, yeah, and he had a big influence on that early artwork of Atari, especially in the arcade world. He would sadly pass away in 1985.
Oh, really?
Yeah, only 50 years old, I think.
Huh.
But also in June of that year, Al Alcorn, who had worked at Ampex.
Yes.
He joins Atari and he begins working on one of Atari's biggest hits, Pong, which is odd in a way. It's odd for a couple reasons. The biggest one being no one ever intended Pong to be a hit.
Yeah. Bushnell at the time was working on a driving game. He said that was really hard.
Yeah.
Driving games still are, I think, one of the tougher ones to get right.
Yeah, to really nail.
Yeah,
exactly.
And he said he hired Alcorn and was like, well, I just wanted to give him a little test.
Yes.
To see how good he was.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't going to throw him on this driving game right away
right.
and so, set him up for failure.
Can you program using this circuit that Dabney
exactly.
produced, right? And because this is a whole new thing, like designing games using this circuit that had been pioneered for the computer space game.
Oh, sure.
So, Alcorn takes this concept and he works on Pong. And unlike the earlier table tennis electronic games, this one had sound.
It sounds so silly, but it was a huge difference.
Yeah.
To actually hear that little
bing, boop, boom, boop.
Yeah. And it had a few other noteworthy characteristics to differentiate it that also sound a little bit like, oh, of course, but
right. It
really made a big difference. The ball sped up
right.
as you played the game,
yep.
which was a huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
And then you talked about some of these sort of happy accidents.
Right.
One of them occurred with Pong. There was that little space at the very top and bottom of the screen
yep.
where you couldn't block. And in other words, a game couldn't go on forever. At some point, you were going to lose it to that corner.
Right. At some bounce, it's going to hit that trajectory
yep.
where no matter what, you can't block it. And
it made it more fun.
And it was a two-player game. So again, it pitched people against each other, just like we were talking about with combat. That creates an experience that just invites that kind of fun sort of, you know, one-upsmanship, trash-talking sort of stuff. You know, nothing. I don't think anyone was making horrible statements like you hear on something like Xbox Live because
right.
you're in person next to whomever.
Sure.
But it also was a much simpler game. It was easy to grasp. The controls were simple. Everyone who saw it knew exactly what the gameplay meant.
Sure.
So it had far greater appeal than something that was much more dense like Computer Space.
Yeah, and the name obviously comes from ping pong, but
yep.
they couldn't call it ping pong, and they couldn't call it ping
right.
because of the golf clubs.
Yep.
And so Pong was just sort of the no-brainer.
Yeah. So the first Pong game was installed in a tavern.
Another great name.
Andy Tapp's Tavern.
Yeah, I looked that up to see if it still existed, and I don't think it does.
Sad.
Yeah.
So the original Pong was black and white, had a black and white television for a screen, and people would come in and play even if they weren't planning on buying anything to eat or drink.
Yeah, it became a destination game.
Yeah, to the point where I read that early in the game's life, they got a call saying, hey, the game's not working. You need to come out here and service it. Yeah. So they came out to find out what was wrong. And what was wrong was that they were using an old milk jug to catch the coins inside the cabinet. And the milk jug had filled to overflowing and no more coins could come in. So the game was malfunctioning.
Such a great story.
So they had to empty the coins from the thing so they could play it. And it was kind of interesting. Like this, we'll talk more about it in a second, but the plan was that in order to give an incentive to businesses to buy into the arcade games,
yeah,
they said, all right, we will split revenue down the middle. 50% goes to you, 50% comes to us.
Sure.
Which literally we will count out the quarters and yeah, you'll get half of them.
And they literally went from place to place, employees of Atari,
yeah,
picking up sackfuls of quarters, yeah, at the end of every day. Yeah.
Possibly suffering enormous back pain. one of whom apparently carried a roofing hatchet for protection.
But they were bringing in, they said a single unit typically would earn about $40 a day, which is over $220 today.
Yeah.
That's fantastic for the first thing of its kind. And it said that they, I believe, 2,500 machines were ordered by the end of 1973.
Right.
And by 1974, over 8,000 of these were all over the country.
Now,
and abroad, I think, at this point.
Yeah, and keep in mind, these are like, you know, a grand a piece, and they're getting this all of the money at this point, because originally they went to Nutting and said, do you want to do this? And they thought, well, no, we don't really want to work with Nutting anymore. We want to be able to do this with someone else. They started shopping around to see if they could work with a different distributor,
right,
of games, like the kind of games you would find at an amusement park.
Sure.
So they look at Bally, because Bally, of course, was famous for their pinball, as well as their other games that they were pioneering in. But Bally wasn't sold on the idea of Pong.
Yeah.
They wanted Atari to make a game for them. In fact, a couple of games. One would be a pinball game and one would be a video game. But they weren't interested in Pong. And ultimately, the guys at Atari decided, you know what, we're going to do this ourselves. But it was a huge, huge jump for them.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have the background in manufacturing.
No, it turned out to be a great move, though.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. It really set them for success for at least the next couple of years. So some interesting things happened in 1973. At the tail end of 72, Atari would file a patent for Pong. Now, keep in mind that when you file a patent, it can take years before you get, you know, that approved or declined.
And it was already released at this point when they filed.
Yes.
They didn't pre-file.
Right. So they file after the game's already released. In 1973, they do something that at first I was confused about until I read more details, which is that they established a second company called Key Games, K-E-E.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand this.
All right. So they set up a second company that's essentially appears to be a competitor to Atari. Not just a competitor, but they are producing knockoffs of Atari games.
Okay.
And here's the reason why. There are rules for certain types of companies where they can only work with a single distributor. So if they create a title and enter an agreement with that distributor, all of their titles have to go through that distributor.
Oh, okay.
So it limits the options of the company producing the games.
Gotcha.
By creating the second company, they could produce the exact same games with a different name.
Yeah.
Under the name of this other dummy corporation, practically.
Right.
It's a little more than a dummy corporation, but not much more. And then offer that to different distributors.
That makes sense.
So it opens up a lot of options. So it's a little
bit
of, yeah, little smoke and mirrors, a little bit of guess which cup the ball is under sort of stuff. And so it was a way of getting around that. Bushnell, by the way, clearly very savvy when it comes to working systems like this.
Sure.
Meanwhile, Pong is going crazy.
Yeah, it's going crazy for many reasons that we already talked about. But another big reason I saw in that interview with Bushnell said is that women were very good at it for some reason. And it appealed to women.
Right.
And it was the first, I guess sort of the first time he said that women felt comfortable going up to a man in a bar and say, hey, you know, do you want to play this game with me?
Right.
And he said that made a big difference. It appealed to both sexes. And it also brought it down, as this great IGN article says, to, you know, where real people congregated.
Right.
It brought it into the bars, into the bowling alleys.
Right.
And it wasn't like, you know, engineering students.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't some computer lab where you had to have, you know, student access to
exactly.
get there. We've got more to say about Atari in just a moment, but we're going to take a quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit att.com/hypergig for details.
Another interesting thing that happened in 1973 was that they got a new space for putting together their Pong machines. Did you hear about this? The 10,000 square foot space they got? So there was one story that Dabney told about how originally the little space they were in, they found out that their neighbor had stopped paying rent and essentially skedaddled.
Okay.
So they cut a hole in the wall and used this next door space. But even that wasn't big enough. Because then they were like, well, what happens when we get caught? Says, well, we'll just ask how much we owe them. When we get caught, we'll pay for it. But until then, we won't.
Yeah.
But then they decided that they would lease a space, and they found a business that was no longer doing business. It was a 10,000 square foot roller rink.
Oh, wow.
And they turned it into their manufacturing center for Pong.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. And then there's the story about how that signed guest thing comes back to haunt them. See, Magnavox.
They did have a patent.
Yes, for electronic table tennis.
Yep.
So Atari did not have a patent for Pong. Magnavox had a patent for electronic table tennis. And this starts to raise some important conversations between the two, where Magnavox is looking at Pong and saying, that's our game, so we're going to go after these guys. Meanwhile, Bushnell buys out Ted Dabney from the company. Depending upon whom you ask, Dabney sometimes just says, no, I was just kind of canned.
Yeah, he says that he was forced out, basically, that his old friend came up to him and basically said, if you don't accept this buyout, then I'm going to take all the assets over to a different company.
Right.
And you'll be left with nothing.
Right.
So and he took the opportunity to get bought out. I didn't see numbers.
Yeah, I didn't either. But, I don't think anyone has ever.
He's still kind of bitter about it sounds like.
Yeah, the interview definitely, he portrays Bushnell as misrepresenting the truth, let's say. That's a very kind way of putting it.
And I haven't heard Bushnell talk much about it. He seems to, I don't know. He
gloss
seem,
over that.
I
or at
I
least not
seen,
even address it.
Yeah, that's from what I've seen.
Well, 1973 was also when Atari got a new hire in the electrical engineering department. You may have heard of him. His name is Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
So Steve Jobs joins Atari in 1973. And by the end of the year, key games in Atari, which remember, are really being operated simultaneously by the same heads of people, enter a licensing agreement for Atari to produce a version of the game Elimination, which was Key Game's first title.
Really?
Yeah. And by the way, can you guess, do you want to guess what the game Elimination was? The title makes it sound like it's something terrible.
No.
Okay.
It wasn't a poopy game?
It was not. It was not. It was a four-player version of Pong.
Oh, okay.
And so the Atari version would become known as Quadra Pong.
Nice.
So it's funny that Atari is licensing a game that essentially the same folks had developed.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like it's all, again, it's all this sort of shell game going on. So moving up to 1974, this is where we start seeing the Magnavox thing come to a head. The inventor, Ralph Baer, convinces Magnavox to sue Atari, claiming that the company copied the electronic table tennis game from the Odyssey.
Which they did.
Yeah, pretty much.
And Bushnell basically comes up. The guy makes all the right moves, it seems like, for a while.
Yeah.
He basically says, you know what, we'll settle for some money and we'll become a licensee.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about us. You go and sue everybody else because Pong was getting knocked off all over the place.
Sure.
And you spend all your time doing that. We'll settle for some money. We'll be a licensee and we'll make that and some other Magnavox games.
Titles, yeah.
Some titles.
Yeah.
And just don't worry about us anymore. And Magnavox was like, all right.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Brilliant. I mean, Atari no longer has to go after these copycats because Magnavox is going to do it on their behalf.
And they're not being come after for Magnavox.
Yeah, so the settlement
provided
amount...
Provided a shield, basically.
Exactly. The settlement amount, it's not publicized, but according to different accounts, it could be anywhere between $400,000 and $1 million. So not
pretty
chump change.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
But still, now you've got like your big brother looking out for you, they can just make money now.
Exactly. It freed them up to be super creative. And that's what they started doing right away, pretty much.
Yeah. And this is also the year, Dabney, who had left, buys the rights to the name Syzygy Game Company from Atari. And then he also would leave the board of directors in 1974, which was his last connection to the company. By that time, Dabney's connections are now severed. And then meanwhile, Key Games releases its first original game called Tank, which ends up being a massive hit.
Yeah.
And then such a big hit. Keep in mind, 1974, Tank comes out. The demand is so high, they go ahead and develop and produce Tank 2 in that same year.
Oh, wow.
Like, you think about how video games are produced. Now, granted, it's a totally different ballgame these days.
Yeah, yeah.
But the way video games are produced these days, they go in for years of development. If you get a game and you won't expect a sequel for several years to come, unless, with a few exceptions, like the Assassin's Creed series appears to have a sequel come out every few months. Certain sports franchise games, obviously, those are going to come out each year to reflect the change.
Season.
Yeah. But most games, you know, you end up waiting years between sequels, but this is where things are just moving at a furious pace.
Now, do we have the home version of Pong yet?
There were some early home versions. There was one that was being developed at this time and actually did come out. Yeah. So there were actually two different versions of that, right? Sears licensed it.
I had that one.
So you had the Sears version of Pong.
The telegames.
Yeah. And then there was a second one that was marketed under the Atari name. So again, it was weird because it almost felt like Atari was competing against itself. It had two different versions of the same thing on the market.
Yeah. Well, because they didn't have that patent yet, I think. So Sears was the distributor and they had their own version.
Yeah.
And so, I think the other versions outsold the official Pong version.
Oh yeah. The Atari, I think Atari had like 50,000 of them on the market, and Sears had 150,000 yeah. of them. It was, you know, easily eclipsing it. But yeah, that ended up being a big hit. That would come out in 1975. It was limited to only playing the Pong games. There was, you know, this was not a cartridge based game.
It was just Pong.
Yeah. So it's all, again, it's hard coded into the console, right?
I played it so much though.
Yeah. I had,
did you have one?
I had one that was, I don't think it was Pong. And I don't think it wasn't the Magnavox Odyssey, because I seem to remember there were sound effects, but I did have one that was the collection of essentially variations on Pong.
Like, yeah.
Pong was one, but you also had Racquetball, which was Pong, but way faster.
Yeah.
Then there was one that was Basketball that was essentially Pong, but it was turned so that both paddles were maybe 2 inches above the bottom line, and then you had like little lines that represented goals.
Is that you had to hit the ball into?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, there was a whole selection of these style games, but they're all just variations on
Pong. Of a square moving around.
Exactly.
A screen.
So I had one of those. I don't know if, hey, listeners, if you know what I'm talking about and you think, oh, that sounds like the blah, blah, blah.
Oh, you'll find out, I bet.
Yeah, you just let me know. But, this is also around the time when Atari would announce the acquisition of Key Games.
How did that work out?
Atari buys its own company.
For a dollar.
Joe Keenan, who, remember, was the head of Key Games. He's also Bushnell's neighbor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. According to a story Dabney told, he says, yeah, Bushnell says he walked up to Joe one day when Joe was mowing his lawn and said, hey, would you like to run a company that looks like it's competing against me?
Yeah, I basically need a shell company owner because I have a shell company.
But Joe Keenan would actually become the new president of Atari, and Nolan Bushnell becomes the chairman of Atari.
Crazy.
And this is also when Atari starts working on a project codenamed Stella.
Yeah.
Now, this is,
change everything.
Again, a home market approach. So two developments make this possible. One is the production of a microchip called the MOS Technology 6052 microprocessor. And then the other one was creating the methodology of storing games on ROM cartridges. ROM stands for read-only memory.
Right.
So this is why if you had one of those old cartridge-based systems, they wouldn't let you do things like keep track of your high score, for example. Like
right.
You'd plug your cartridge in and you could get a high score, but as soon as you turned the machine off, it's erased.
Yep.
Because it was read-only memory. It couldn't write anything. So, the console would have all the stuff that would allow it to accept these cartridges. But the beauty of it was you were not limited to a select number of titles. As long as more cartridges would come out, you could play different games.
Yeah. And, you know, we should set the scene here in the early to mid 1970s. There was not a lot of options. As a child.
No.
You had crappy handheld games.
Yeah, Tiger Electronics type stuff.
Yep. You had a few TV channels that you could watch.
Three, maybe four if you could get a UHF station.
It was pre-Fox even.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the big three.
ABC, NBC, and CBS.
And there were, you know, all the games were like, you know, there were card games and
yeah.
You know, or actually playing outside with your friends, which is
great. Oh, good Lord.
But but there was not a lot. There weren't many options. So home computing and the home video console was, to call it revolutionary, there isn't a word big enough to call it what it was.
Right. And so keep in mind, this is the dawn of two eras that are coming about at the same time. They're both about to change children's worlds forever.
Yeah.
One is that the arcade is on the horizon. Like,
yes.
not just the, you know, occasional game in a bar or a restaurant or a bowling alley.
Yeah, and they had arcades previously, but like we said, it was pinball and skee ball and stuff like that.
Right. So the video arcade is just about to come to pass, and the home video game market is about to come to pass.
Oh, man.
Suddenly we have way more options than, you know, finding out who's really good at getting hit with a stick. That was my favorite game as a kid. I was really good at that game.
Yeah.
I could get hit by a stick like crazy.
With the best of them.
So 1976, we get a game coming out from Atari called Breakout.
Yeah, designed. Well, we thought it was designed and perfected by Steve Jobs because he was the employee assigned to that job.
Yeah, Bushnell and Bristow, Steve Bristow, who was another employee of Atari, came up with the concept and gave it to Steve Jobs and said, make this thing that we've thought of.
Right.
It was essentially kind of a racquetball style game. And so Jobs goes back, does some work, comes back with a circuit board and says, I did it. And they hook it up and they're like, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so great. You have done such a good job designing this where you've created a really efficient system. Like we would have thought that you would have to use, you know, a dozen or more other processors to get this done, but you've managed to make a really elegant solution to it. We're going to give you a bonus. Here's an extra $5,000.
Yeah. And he was like, yeah, my friend Waz was maybe a little bit more responsible than I let on.
Yeah, there's this guy I know. I went to college with him. He works for HP. His name's Steve Wozniak.
He's really good at this stuff.
He made this thing. So yeah, Wozniak actually built the integrated circuit that was used in Breakout.
And Breakout was and is still a great game.
Yes.
It's another one of those that holds up.
It really does.
Very challenging, great gameplay. A challenge.
And then as soon as the success hit Jobs, he said, all right, guys, see ya. And then he and Wozniak and a person who was one of the developers over at Atari all go to form a little company called Apple.
That's right.
It took them a couple of years to get things going, but they, of course, would end up kind of repeating the success that Atari was seeing in the video game market with the personal computer market. So, in a way, you could think of Atari as being at least partially responsible, not just for the video game industry, but also the personal computer industry, because otherwise Jobs might not have had the inspiration and the capital to really go out and say, let's do this thing. So it's kind of cool. Bushnell, by the way, decides he's ready to cash out.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the problems was they had this great idea for the VCS, or what would become the Atari 2600.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really fund it, to the extent that they needed to scale this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to cash in and just have a little more, backing basically. And so he made it's a pretty interesting decision in the long run to sell to Warners.
Yeah. He sells to Warner Communications for $28 million. He walks away with $15 million of that.
Yeah, and they all of a sudden, I saw an interview with Alcorn that he was like, we had real money in the bank for the first time.
Yeah.
He said we had backing and we felt safe. But, here's the problem. Atari was a very fun company to work for, to put it lightly.
Like, have you seen Wolf of Wall Street? Because I have a feeling that Atari was a little
really
like
was.
That.
They said there were a lot of marijuana smoking. They called it an MRB session, Marijuana Review Board.
Yeah.
He said, one of the developers in the interview that I saw today said, we would basically sit around and get high and brainstorm games.
Yeah.
They said it was the days before sexual harassment. There were a lot of people going home with each other in the end of the night.
Well,
and then cocaine came onto the scene.
Another thing to think about is a lot of these game consoles, or the different projects they have, if you look, a lot of the code names are women's names.
Yeah.
And according to most of the interviews I've seen, the names were picked from attractive ladies who were receptionists or secretaries at Atari.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really, you know, forward-thinking, classy type stuff.
Yeah, nerd humor.
But at any rate, you know, Warner is...
Well, they changed everything.
They're a big corporation.
Yeah, that you couldn't come and go as you pleased anymore. Yeah. They would talk about the way they dressed.
Right.
You were, you know, like I said, you were responsible for being there at a certain time every day and leaving at a certain time. And that did not fly with these creative startup minds, basically.
Right. Yeah, so it caused a lot of tension. Meanwhile, Bushnell would go off to finally really work on a project he had been thinking about since the early 70s, something that he really wanted to do. He had this idea of creating a destination for families to be like just a money-making machine.
Yeah.
A pizza parlor where you would have entertainment and electronic games and other like Midway-style games, and it would just be a license to print money.
Yep.
And that, my friends, is how Chuck E. Cheese was born.
Yeah. And I saw that interview with Dabney where he was talking to him about it at first. And Dabney was like, the pizza's crappy.
Yeah, it's just,
and well, it's too loud in here.
He's like, well, I need it to be loud, and the pizza just has to be mediocre at best.
Yeah, and you know what? He was right.
Yep.
Because the pizza was never good, and every one of us loved that place as a kid.
I want to do an episode at some point looking – I don't know if I can do it because I don't know if it really falls into tech stuff, but I would love to do the story – of Chuck E. Cheese and Showbiz Pizza.
Yeah.
I grew up knowing Showbiz Pizza, not Chuck E. Cheese.
I remember
Showbiz Pizza specifically.
Yeah.
And if you think the two are kind of similar and you were wondering, I mean, granted, they both belong to the same entity now.
Yeah.
But if you thought the two were kind of similar, it's because the creators of Showbiz Pizza originally worked on the Chuck E. Cheese
program. Really?
And then there was a falling out and a split. So
there was another one in Atlanta called Sergeant Singer's.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
And I had a little quick side story here. When I was like 12, the new, it may have been Showbiz actually opened up, and for their grand opening, they had an invitation only thing that somehow my dad was an elementary school principal that got an invitation to this. To come with his kids, and you basically walk in and everything was free that night.
Wow.
So free food. They gave you just sackfuls of tokens anytime you wanted them. And it was literally stands out as one of the best nights of my childhood. I still remember it to this day as being like one of the most fun things I've ever done.
I could see that. I mean, that would be a dream come true.
It was all free.
Oh man.
It was crazy. It blew my mind.
Well, we have talked for a long time. We've got a lot more to cover, but in order to do that, we're going to end here. I'm calling it now. I'm looking at the time. It's over 50 minutes already.
Ooh,
so
wow. Teasing right before the release of the 2600.
I know. We got to have a reason for people to come back next
week,
right?
Yeah, things are about to get really good.
Yeah, we've got tons more to talk about. I mean, we haven't even left the 70s yet.
No, man.
And trust me, like, we've got some drama coming up with the rise and fall of the video game industry as a whole, not to mention the crazy corporate shuffling of the Atari brand, yeah, which is kind of heartbreaking. I hope you enjoyed that classic episode about the rise and fall of Atari. Like I said, we've got two more parts coming up covering that series. So we will continue this story next week. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, please reach out to me. The Twitter handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.